Khobar Towers was a terrorist attack on an American military installation in Saudi Arabia and killed 17 airmen. They drove a truck bomb in front of the barracks and blew it up. So we started after that. A lot of work went into that. It's 100 times more difficult to try to do something overseas than in the States.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to part two of our interview with former FBI Supervisor Dale Watson, and welcome back to the Game of Crimes with Murph in the Morning. This is, as you heard in episode one, this is a real honor for me to have Dale on here with us. He was involved in so many international incidents as well as domestic incidents. I mean, the last thing we were talking about was the Oklahoma City bombing before we move on to the next one. And during our little break here, Dale was telling me there's a couple more things that he wanted to point out to us. And so I want to ask him to come back and let's revisit Oklahoma City bombing one more time and just fill us in on those things, Dale. This is so interesting to hear from somebody who was actually there.
Yeah, it was a very stressful time. We were all away from home, 120, 150 miles, and we stayed in all the hotels that we could get.
Mm-hmm.
And did a great job. There were a couple of points I wanted to make about the actual investigation of that. The issue was, where did they meet to mix up the bomb, the actual bomb? And that occurred at Gary State Lake, which is park, which is about 20 miles. And I think I explained about that in mm-hmm. episode one. The interesting thing was that we needed probably some witnesses that could have verified that the car was there and Nichols' truck was there at the same time the bomb truck was there. And uh-huh. we had the brilliant idea of, it's a state road. It's not a rural road. And so we decided to go ahead and put up a roadblock coming and going on work days, a couple of work mm-hmm. days. And you'd be surprised how much traffic went through there. But also there were about memory fading, but I think there were four or five individuals that said, I saw a rental truck over there. They described McVeigh's or the rental truck and Nichols's pickup truck that he drove. And so that's where that tied in with the stuff on the ground and the fibers that were left by. So it's a great job. It triggered for me when I told that again to talk about resources, particularly mm-hmm. on a big case or disaster of any kind, a hurricane. I've never worked those, but for Oklahoma City and for later, a lot of those places overseas that we had to respond to, and even the ones in the U.S., I was told that to go out to Kansas City and enjoy yourself. And because the guy that sent me there, besides the director, was the deputy director. And he made a point to me. He said, you need to do the liaison work. And we all know that. And
right.
In spite of you want to be at home, you need to go to probably some fish fries and really be sincere about it. And that was good advice. I took that. And then he said, one of the key things in survival, and particularly in a crisis, is that if something happens and you think you need 5 agents or 10 agents, you take 15 or 20. He said, you cannot catch up. If you show up with not enough people, you will never get caught up. It's that you need, and you wish you'd had. So I took that into account. We also had Nichols's old car and not Nichols, but McVeigh's old car.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
we had Nichols. Yeah, no, McVeigh. And then we had Nichols's truck and his vehicles. And what we decided to do was, we still hadn't figured out at that point where there were any explosives purchased or dead cord found. We made a conscious decision to go around the hotels in the state of Kansas and see if any of those vehicles were registered long before when it was computerized. And they didn't stay in the Hilton and they didn't stay at Marriott. I think we ended up hand searching. I really hate to put a number on this. I'd heard a figure. I don't think it's true, but I think there were over 100 and hundreds of thousands of hotel receipts. And of that,
Whoa. We
got four that had him signing in the car. with the tag number, but a different name. And so we knew that he was traveling around. That led back to Wichita, and I think they tried to figure out that the jet fuel or highly explosive stuff was bought down there. We never could figure that one out.
Holy cow.
Hard work, stay the course.
You talk about tedious work, sitting there going through those registrations. Again, you got to look for the name, but you also got to look for the tag number.
It was paper. Oh. They were all paper, and we had boxes of normally, we would just go and say, hey, so-and-so stayed here. I mean, there was a short, closed, pretty wide-open window, I think probably a month or so before the bombing. And then that was a detail I didn't want to get on, but I mean, they jumped in. They jumped in and did it. Going through those things. Ooh, man.
I'm sure there's more than one agent sitting there going through it, and after about 7 or 8 hours, he's going, why did I become an FBI agent?
Yeah, exactly. But... You'd be surprised the names that came out of there that shouldn't have been there.
Okay.
You're talking about an Intel database.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't know you were out there, did you? That wasn't you, was it now?
The first thoughts came to my mind was politicians, but
we're not going to go that far, but that you're pretty smart, so I don't let that go. We don't want to talk about politicians.
Smarter than the average bear here. Yeah.
Why are you doing this? You're not going to Topeka to look around, are you? Yeah, sure.
No.
I don't agree, Dale. You shouldn't do that. Oh, okay. That's right, Congressman.
And ladies and gentlemen, you're seeing the sense of humor that Dale Watson has. It's hilarious. I tell you, you see me keep rubbing my eyes. It's because I've got tears in my eyes from laughing at this guy.
Fantastic. They got a lot of people nervous.
Yeah, I'll bet it did. I'll bet it did.
I mean, but we did the right thing.
I don't know if you ever heard this, but you've lived in D.C. long enough, and we both lived out in Loudoun County there. And when I heard the history of Leesburg, and we're talking way back in colonial times, you know, when they built the railroad between Washington and Leesburg, it was the way the history was told me is that's just where the houses of ill repute were. And that's where the people in Washington.
I don't know about that, but George Washington was out there a lot surveying.
There you go.
I don't know what he was surveying, but he was surveying.
They say the oldest sin in the world, right?
All right, get off of that.
I'm ready.
This is a family show.
So now you finish up your time, and man, that bombing just had to be so time-consuming that I don't know how you got anything else done, but it was for the right reason.
That's all I did. That's all I did for that whole time. I got back, and the Bureau rewarded all of us. They gave us 2 days off.
Saturday and Sunday?
I only took one because I had to do something else. And then, son of a gun, I'm not back 2 weeks. I mean, you're just spent for something like that. You go, you get everything you want, all the resources you need, and then you come back and there's your inbox and there's your outbox, and it's the same old. So it's the same old stuff. Put papers here in the morning, you move it over here and it's empty, and then in the morning you get in that rut and you say, oh man, I've been out there living off of adrenaline for a while, not the whole time, but certainly. And then Bryant, he calls the deputy director, good friend, I mean, very smart guy. He calls and says, hey, Dell, he says, there's an Amtrak train derailment out in Arizona and it kills some people, and I want you to go out there and help them. I said, really? He says, yeah, go out there and help him. It's out in the desert. I got pulled into the train derailment almost like 2 weeks after I got back.
Why did the Bureau get involved in something like that?
Terrorism.
Oh, it was?
Yeah. It wasn't, but they thought it was.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And killed Americans, and it was a nasty thing. And went out there and was way out in the desert, and I just dog tired, but that's okay. I'm back to reality and living life good in Kansas, I guess, after Oklahoma City, April. I got back June, July, went to Arizona. I guess it's October in the fall, and I'm really kind of enjoying it and getting back in the stride of just regular ASAC duty.
Mm-hmm.
And December, I get a call from Bryant, and at night, And he gets on there and he's checking in. He said, "Dale, how you doing?" I said, "I'm doing fine. What's up?" He says, "I've got a job for you." And I said, "Where?" I got the best job I'll ever have out here. These people are really nice and it's good. And he says, "Yeah, I know. I had that job." I said, "Well, okay." I said, "What is it?" And he says, "Well, the director wants to assign you over to the CIA. And I said, "What for? I don't like those people. I don't know those people." And at the time, if you took a detailed assignment outside the mainstream, you're not going anywhere.
Yeah.
Who wants to be a liaison with somebody like that?
And at any point in your life, did you ever think you'd get a phone call that says, "Hey, FBI agent, we want you to go to the CIA.
No. And they said, "Well, the CIA stuff, the criminal stuff, you didn't really." And I said, "Well, if it's such a good job," I literally told him this. I had that relationship with him. I said, "If it's such a good job, just call for volunteers. You'll get 50 people out in the field that are dying to go back to headquarters. I'm not going back." And he says, well, right. You think about that. Kind of, he calls back again about a week later. "Hey, this is really a good job." I said, "What is it?" And he said, "Their counterterrorism center, we're swapping deputies in the operational side, and you need to take that job." I said, "I don't need to take that job, seriously."
And this is a promotion, right?
Yeah.
To an SES, Senior Executive Service?
Yeah, that is an SES slot, and that's where I made it. I'll tell you that story a little bit later. I don't think anything about it, and then like January 8th is burned in my mind, or 10th or something. I'm working there, and it's late at night, and it's an hour later here, and so our switchboard calls down to the office there. It says, "Dale, the director's office is on the phone. They want to talk to you." And I said, "Really?" And I'm thinking, some guy's pulling my leg or something. So I pick up the phone and it's the director of the FBI. And he says, he usually talked about the family, how's the family, you know, blah, blah, blah. I mean, very good guy. No, he was kind of short. He said, "I'll put you out there. I'll take you back anytime I want. Have a good evening." And so
May I have another?
Once again, the needs of the Bureau superseded anything that I had planned to do. And so I looked at the phone and I'm thinking, this is not right. You don't treat people like this. I mean, really, we had an old system that based on seniority, you could pick an office and eventually get to it. If the need was for people, they'd get moved up the list. I went and looked at the Jacksonville OP list. And I signed up when I was at Quantico, and I think I was 45 then on the list, and looked, and I was like 28. There's no way I could get an OP anytime soon. That jumped my career.
Who was the director at that time?
Director Freeze.
Yeah. I'm not dissing him at all for doing that, because it is, we all signed that agreement to do that.
That's right. That's exactly.
It sucks. It sucks when it happens to you. It's funny when it happens to somebody else.
You know, in hindsight, it was the best thing that could have possibly happened to me before now.
Yeah.
And all that work overseas and all that stuff, I better be careful here. I would read all the cables in the morning. And if there was a leak that was mentioned, it's like, you can't get anything done. I'd get on that and I'd resolve that. And a lot of times I'd come back and say, "This, whoever wrote this, that's not right. This is what actually happened." It protected the FBI. I learned what a chief of station does, and learned or interface with the ambassadors. And the agency, to their credit, really opened up and saw the underbelly there. And they're good people. And I remember being so stupid. The guy I worked for said, "Dale, I want you to go to L.A. and pick up this stuff or something." I went out to the secretary and said, "I need a plane ticket to Los Angeles." And she says, "For what?" I said, "Well, so-and-so wants me to go do something." She said, "Well, you crazy fool. What was it? It was the Latin American division of the CIA, which is up on the fifth floor or something of the building I was in." So I didn't even know their language.
Yeah.
And they had all these codes and stuff. They wanted me to travel around. And I said, I'd like to see a working station to understand how it fits in and that. I did that, but they'd say, well, why don't you go visit Rome, man? And I'm over here to learn. I'm not, so I didn't take any pleasure trips with them, but they were very good. And it taught me exactly their capabilities overseas.
Was your office in Langley?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. And George, I got to know the CIA director very well, George Tenet, and they did well. At the same time, though, when I said, I don't know those people, I don't want to go do this, the guy they selected to come over to the FBI to be the deputy told them basically the same thing. I don't like the FBI. I don't know them. I don't want to work over there.
Yeah.
They're a bunch of knuckle draggers, and they were friends. They were lifelong friends. But it comes in real handy, man. You can sort out between DO officers and DI officers at a minute's notice. People say, yeah, I work for the CIA. All you have to do is ask them, are you DI or DO?
Mm-hmm.
And the DO people are really the ones that, but I mean, DI is important. They read reports and analyze stuff. So I'm not criticizing, never criticize them. They're a good organization.
Right.
But they're all getting
And eventually DEA ended up where we were doing that liaison over. We had a guy here on the show, Matt Addington, on episode 164 that was, he may have been the first to have that assignment over there. I'm not sure, but he sang the praises of the benefits of having liaison.
Yeah, it is. And we all say that, but I mean, it's absolutely the truth. And they'd want to parade their FBI representative around.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, come meet with us, the Philippine whoever it was or what. Coming in there wearing, well, I better not talk about it.
Yeah.
And you can buy a $1,200 suit, foreign representative coming in to visit you from a broke company or country, you get the picture.
Yeah, it doesn't quite jive, does it?
No, it doesn't.
Now, but I enjoyed it. Well, when you're in that position, is that when the Khobar Tower incident happened?
Yeah. Yeah.
June 96.
Yeah, definitely. Or
that was the
before I got there. Yeah, I was there.
Was before you got
there. No. You're right. That happened right after I got there. And I was involved with that. And I inherited it later to try to fix, too. So when I went back to headquarters. So I stayed there from June to December or January. I was there. Khobar happened, I think, in July or something. I don't know. But we got tied up in that. I got tied up into that really heavy.
And if you would, just tell everybody what this is about, the people that don't know what Khobar Towers was.
Khobar Towers was a terrorist attack on an American military installation in Saudi Arabia in Khobar. And it killed 17 airmen. Mm-hmm. And they drove a truck bomb in front of the barracks and blew it up and killed them. Yeah. And so we started after that. A lot of work went into that. It's 100 times more difficult to try to do something overseas than in the States. Some hotel doesn't want to give you their records. And you can go down to the United States Attorney's Office, get a subpoena and subpoena them. So, but you can't do that. You got to finesse anything with the government, particularly a government that's very concerned about if we help you and you solve this, what are you going to do about it?
Yeah.
If you're going to bomb our neighbor, we want to know, and maybe that's not the right thing. So you have to develop those relationships, and it takes a long time. But Saudi Arabia stuck with it, and we were able to, in fact, identify that it was a Hezbollah deal from supported by the IRGC in Iran.
And that's the Royal Guard, right?
Yeah, that's some of the bad guys. But it was I don't know if I've explained this well enough, but it was a trying time in the fact that for the first time I saw our government waffle on doing the right thing.
Really?
Yeah, probably I'll stop at that point.
Okay. Curiosity piqued.
Yeah. They were the most senior leadership in our government. We were trying to solve the thing. We did everything we could to solve it. We had plenty of help, the agency. But at the same time, other people were curious about what we were doing and at what level of understanding we knew and where the responsibility was placed. Mm-hmm. Because they didn't know what they would have to do. And I remember distinctly remembering that. I could tell you some stories that make your hair stand up over that situation. Well, but I don't talk about that. And so, and you, from an FBI perspective or DEA perspective, what's wrong with these people? These killed Americans.
Right.
Well,
absolutely.
You don't have enough. You don't have enough evidence. You don't. I mean, it was almost like what my father told me, who never had been involved in politics. He said, I don't think you can trust any of them. And I said, no, yeah. Dad, there's some good ones. And there's some good ones. And there's some not so good.
Yeah.
And it's all about
this. This is all public record. And if you, mm-hmm. you know, if our listeners are interested in doing a little more research, I'm not doing anything to make Dale uncomfortable here because I certainly don't want him to say anything that could, you know, be considered classified from back in the day.
That's true.
But it was, I think, from what I read about it, there was some hope by our leadership that Iran, because they brought a new leader in, could possibly want to do the right thing. And that's what I read. That's where the waffling came in, because all of a sudden it was all gung-ho. But then, oh, wait a minute, we got a chance that we would come up to an agreement with Iran, and all they did was stick it right up our rear end like they have always done, and they still do to this day. So, and that's not politics. That's just, that's the world. It's the world we live in.
The problem, not the problem, go ahead, please. I didn't mean to interrupt. I've been talking.
No, I was going to say, eventually, were there people arrested because of the Khobar Tower bombing? Were they brought to the United States?
I think I'll stop at that point.
Okay. All right. So, and then, now this, so you come out of the CIA. Was that bittersweet when you left?
Yeah, it was. I mean, it really was. I never thought about it that way, but I knew I needed them. I needed them later on, and needed them for a lot of reasons, because after Oklahoma City bombing case, the U.S. government passed the law, the Effective Penalty in Death Act for terrorism, any attack terrorism. And what mm-hmm. they put in there was, and this changed part of my ability to not have to work 80 hours a week. They said anything over 2 ounces of an explosive was a act of terrorism. And any event that harms or kills a U.S. citizen overseas was the responsibility of the FBI. And so, boom, you have all these cases that come up. And we've mm-hmm. been working for that, though. There were certain cases we'd been working on. We were working on Zach Hernandez's murderer, Sergeant E5 that was killed down in Panama, Joe Inchesmar, who killed the New Jersey State Police guy years ago. She's down, mm-hmm. was down in Cuba at the time.
Yep.
And we had the bombers of TWA 847, I think it was, where the old famous, you know, Time magazine front cover had the guy holding the pistol to the pilot's head. We knew who did that. We knew where they were, and we were trying to leverage them to get them back to the States.
Mm-hmm.
Not thousands, but at least 50 or 60 other episodes where bird watchers would go down to Columbia, State Department and DEA would say, don't go out of the city, and they'd go mm-hmm. out in the city and get kidnapped. And yeah. then they'd The first ring rings at my home at night is Senator so-and-so says, hey, Dale, I'm a big supporter of the FBI. I said, thank you, Senator. What do you need? And he says, well, the Jones family has been a big contributor of ours, and their granddaughter got kidnapped down in Colombia. He said, how's that case going? And I said, well, actually, they were told, the State Department put out, and I think you guys put out a notice that stay out of the jungles. I mean, it was a civil war going on with the FARC. Yeah. Well, I expect you guys to do something. And it just, we had all that stuff.
What a nightmare. So,
yeah. I mean, it really was. And one of the senators deceased sent somebody to observe on his staff the election in Thailand. They were two parties, observed the election process, was what he told me. And so he's over there, and then they got together on two rallies at the same place, same time. Somebody threw a hand grenade into one of the political parties. It went off. I don't think it killed anybody, but a small piece of shrapnel went into this staffer leg cap. And he calls me and says, well, that's a case. You need to open up a case on it. I says, what was he doing over there? What? We're done spending resources, time, and effort trying to convict somebody. I mean,
what was his answer? I wanted him there.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's to save face. Save face with this family that gives him money or something, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
I mean, we went through that, and I did that all the time. I went through the process of looking at those old cases, and some of them we had real chances, and, I mean, worked hard to get them. I went to several places and leveraged that.
Yeah.
It was an ongoing thing that was secondary to trying to protect the country.
Yep. When you were telling us about the new responsibilities for the FBI, I want to point out to our listeners here that DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration, is what's called a single mission agency, and their only responsibility is to investigate narcotics violations against Americans in the United States.
Do a good
now,
job.
The FBI, we used to make a point of this when we were doing the teaching down there at Dam Neck, Virginia with the SEAL team. How many crime categories is the FBI responsible for?
It's
we
like
got one.
270, I think. I've forgotten the number, but it's way up there. Back to when
I think it's closer
to
400.
I think so. And when I was in Birmingham, I got horse thief, enters the Mann Act, stealing his car. I mean, it was just crazy. It was crazy. I mean,
and then they've even got one category that says if nobody else was responsible for it, the FBI is responsible for it.
That's true. That's true.
That's unbelievable.
It doesn't fall under jurisdiction. So that's right. So it was a full-time job.
So that you've had your time with the CIA. And one thing I want to mention about the CIA for our listeners, just in case, and most of you do know this because I'm pretty familiar with a lot of our audience, but the CIA is, they're not allowed technically and legally to investigate Americans. And they're not to conduct investigations within the United States, although there are exceptions. And that's where the FBI comes in, because they are authorized to investigate Americans, and they are authorized to work over in the overseas environment. So that's the important. The reason I want to point that out, that's the importance of having you in there or any cross liaison going on, because you have agencies have different responsibilities, but you can complement each other when you understand what the other agency's mission is and how they're trying to achieve those purposes. When I mentioned Matt Addington was liaison, he was telling us in his interview that DEA stopped doing that.
Hmm.
I mean, you look at Grenada, that's when our military realized they needed a purple command because nobody was talking to each other, right? So I don't understand that, but I've been retired since 13, and nobody seems to call and ask my advice anymore. I just don't understand that, Dale. So anyway, yeah. Now you get the headquarters pulls you back in and puts you in the you have a division within the FBI called the National Security Division, right? NSD.
Not at that time.
Okay.
We had the terrorism section that reported underneath elements of Division 5, which was the intel section, chase spies and stuff.
So they bring you in and they make you chief of the international terrorism section, right?
That's correct. That's correct. And that had all the terrorism stuff in it and everything. And that just kept going. It just kept getting bigger and bigger and got more involved in the liaison aspect of building relationships with State Department. I had good relationships at the agency. State Department's a different animal. There are good people over there. DOD was a member of the counterterrorism working group up at the White House that had Dick Clark and a bunch of representatives that, you know, we met, and they stayed out of the operational stuff. I mean, they'd give suggestions. Sometimes they'd say, put that person under surveillance, and say, that's an operational decision. We'll make that if we need to do that. But thank you for the suggestion. And then we'd team up and vote against somebody or something. I mean, it was good. But DOJ was heavily involved, and they wanted to be, since they would have to prosecute whatever it was. And so that was, spent a lot of time doing that. Spent a lot of time as, I think I'm the, I'm the section chief. And spent a lot of time, I think I was over in the African work or the bombing. So I've forgotten the exact sequence here. But I realized after the two embassy bombings, I was a deputy assistant director. I'd gotten promoted up. Mm-hmm. And I realized that this priority and what our priorities are, how we're going about our doing our business, the FBI business, was really not very successful. And I thought, all we do is react to this stuff. We do great things after East Africa bombing. We develop the rapid deployment systems and, three different locations around the FBI, New York, Los Angeles, Miami. We're assigned portions of the world to react to acts of terrorism. And that was a great thing because we'd gone from having one field office try to do it to having numerous resources planted. And fast forward, I knew that we were going to get attacked sometime before 9/11. And I was on the verge of pre-positioning some supplies and materials in the Far East. So that's where I thought the effort would have been. But to my point that I'm trying to make here is, I don't know. I woke up. I was gone. I realized I'd visited someplace. I think it was the embassy bombings. And I came back to the office, sat down there Monday. Here's my inbox. It's full. Here's my outbox. It's full. In the middle is my calendar that I have little or no control over. Got to be at State Department, got to go to the agency, all up the bam, blah, blah, blah. And so I realized that all we were doing was just playing catch up. And I said, I can't live like this anymore. I can't look myself in the mirror and say we're doing all we can to prevent these things. And so that led me down to a different program and a different set of concepts that the Bureau changed to long before 9/11, or were working on it at the time of 9/11. So I don't know if that was the question, or that the people always flag the FBI. You guys are just reactive. The bank is robbed. We solve it. The person gets kidnapped. We solve it. The person steals fraud or something. And those are post events. And And I said, really, if we want to try to protect the country, we need to be the best we can at this. And we need to have accountability for people that are working this program. And so we started down that. A guy that triggered me was a professor now out in University of California. He was doing some work for the deputy director. I've forgotten what it was. The deputy director actually said, well, go talk to Dell about it. He might have some ideas or something. And so he came in and started talking about strategic planning. And I said, okay, that's great. And we always do strategic planning. We'd write 100-page strategic plan for 5 years. And guess what? It sits on the shelf and collects dust. And the only time you look at it is when you need to write the next one. And so I was determined. I said, I don't have time for this. This is all phony. And after I got back, I think it was from East Africa. It might have been one of the other. It might have been the USS Cole. I can't remember. That I decided we need to change. We need to hold people accountable for doing things, particularly our field offices. And we need to be doing everything we can possibly do to prevent these things. And that included across the board liaison intelligence with local state police. I was convinced that the next terrorist act in the United States would be prevented by local or state police seeing something and reporting it. And we had no way of reporting. And when 9/11 happened, they were driving cross country and got a ticket, speeding ticket in Oklahoma. I'd like to have known about that. I didn't know it. Or they were living here right under our nose and in an apartment in Fairfax County. And so those bits and pieces, and I knew that probably any terrorist act coming at us would eventually get to the U.S. And I knew that probably somewhere in our files that lead could have been true, that somebody would have reported something, wrote a blind memo, put it in zero file, and then after an event, they search all that stuff, and here it is, right? Here it is, Phoenix memo. The guy's flying, says he doesn't want to learn how to land or something. I mean, different people got picked up. The ones out in San Diego was able to get to L.A. and then down. So, but there were reasons for that. A lot of it, though, was focused upon, most of it was initially focused upon our field offices, and we called it Max Capo 5. So the guy that came in and talked to me, he left. I called one of my unit chiefs in. I said, I don't care what you write or what he says. You just do that. Get him out of here. I don't want to ever talk to him again. And so I changed. Once again, I changed my perspective rather quickly. Mm-hmm. That this was something we needed to do. I believe that after 9/11, there were a hue and cry to try to blame the FBI and to change the FBI and split the FBI into two organizations like Canada has. They have the RCMP police and they have the Canadian Intelligence Service. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't want that to happen because of the history that the FBI had and their ability to work both sides. So kind of a rambling story.
Yeah, but it's all history, and it's a lot of the history of the FBI and how it continued to evolve. I enjoy hearing it just because you gain more knowledge from it.
Yeah.
The two embassies, were you in that position as the DAD?
Yeah.
When the two embassies in Nairobi and Tanzania yes. were bombed?
Yes, I traveled over there with the director and saw both of those, saw the bloodshed. It's just a horrible thing. Mm-hmm. Most people don't know this, but they went under, tried to get under the American embassy. They didn't, but they got out. Two of the guys got out, and one of them threw a percussion grenade, and it made a loud bang, a distraction.
Mm-hmm.
Most of those injuries to the citizenship there was from, there were buildings with high glass, you know, glass tall buildings. And
Right. They,
when that thing went off, I tell people, if you hear a big bang, don't run to the window to look to see what it was. Wait, because what happened was after that percussion grenade, within a matter of seconds, the big bomb went and it cut those people. They'd run to the windows and cut their faces up and cut out. You know, a lot of damage was done through that. And that was just a minor thing, but it was a big thing to them. And then there were other fascinating stories that I could tell you about the embassy bombings that make some of the similar things happen in Oklahoma City, but I need to leave those inside.
Okay. During these embassy bombings, is that when there was the discussion about putting Mylar on the windows, which, you know, keeps the glass from shattering? It's like putting a film on the windows that protects you.
It might have been. I didn't get involved in that. I didn't know.
It's just, and the reason
we
I
were
ask
living
is
off the economy. I know that. So
yeah, and this happened in 1998. And I know when we got to Columbia in 1991, 7 years earlier, when it was a danger, it was considered a danger post. That when we would rent an apartment, they would come in and put Mylar on the windows, and that was in case there was a bombing.
Yeah.
You don't have all those shards of glass flying around everywhere. It's like film. It keeps it all together.
This was their commercial buildings. It wasn't the embassy.
Okay. Gotcha.
And the embassy lost people and lost a guy that I knew there working DSS with the State Department. And so it was a terrible thing. I mean, obviously. Mm-hmm. And then one of them escaped to one of the small islands, and we barely missed him. So it's a long, drawn-out deal.
Yeah. And this is,
that's
this
where
is
just, I call the NA guy, too, so he helped a lot.
And these are just straight-out terrorist acts against the United States.
Right, that's right. That's right. But then there's a dilemma here, though, and I'll ask you this, Steve. Maybe you can ask the audience. If you're working at an embassy or if you're assigned to an embassy, I never have been assigned to an embassy overseas. If you do that, and then there's a threat that comes in that says terrorists are planning to attack the embassy this week, And the first thing the ambassador does is he closes the embassy for 2 days. And then I always figured 2 days, they're going to go somewhere else and hide for a month and come back. Mm-hmm. And all you're doing is tipping them off that something's up. Right. We had that happen in, I got to fuzz up some facts here, in one of the states in the United States out of Argentina, I think it was, Venezuela, I think, where it was a direct report that three, four Hezbollah people were coming up to bomb this mall, shopping mall, and they'll be there this weekend. Got the information. I called back. I said, whoever the source is, get him in there and polygraph. Well, he left. He walked in. He didn't. We don't have any identification on him other than a picture. And he's not involved, he says. I said, well, that's great. So here it is Thursday. What are you going to do? Are you going to tell the people at the mall, the businesses, and what are they going to do? They're going right. to close the, or some, you don't tell anybody, and you say, well, this is all baloney. You don't tell anybody, and the mother with two children walking around the mall get blown up. You think you'll survive that inquiry? So right. it's really tricky.
It's a catch-22.
It is. And I don't know. Not luck, but, you know, you do what you have to, especially you don't know who these guys are. If you go out and say, people of the mall close the business, they say, we'll lose business. You don't know this is going to happen. And at right. the same time, it's well, if we don't, I kind of roll the dice on those, but always caution on the side, be cautious to do it. And right. those decisions are not easily made. And then you have a ton. Of false claims.
Mm-hmm.
One particular came in Friday night, as always, trying to go home for the weekend. Friday night, hey, we just got this message on the internet or some way electronically that somebody's going to blow up the National Zoo Saturday morning at 10:30 in D.C. And said, well, mommy, what are we going to do now? And
yeah.
so it required massive amounts of resources. You had to get half of Washington field office to go over there, make sure that all the cell phones are covered, make sure blah, 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 blah. And we were working it all night to try to figure out where this thing came from. And it was signed Red Monkey Terrorist Organization. So we finally, and I won't name the exact country, but it was overseas. We ran it down, knocked on the door of the house. I'm surprised they didn't kick it down. And said, is John here? And they said, well, yes, it's late. What's this about? We need to talk to John. So John's down in the basement. He's 15 years old on the computer. And he is the Red Monkey Terrorist Organization. I laugh about it, but it wasn't funny, you know?
Right.
People screaming
right.
and yelling and not really. But do you tell the White House? I don't know.
Mm.
Who knows?
Well, I would think you would tell the White House because you're justifying your positions. You're showing them that, hey, it's Friday night and this is what we're doing, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So,
then you
get a bunch of referees in there that says this or that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but we did. We didn't roll the dice too many times, even though.
Well, it doesn't matter what you do. You're going to have critics, right or wrong. Somebody's going to criticize you for whatever action you take.
That's right. That's exactly right. And it's always 20/20 hindsight. Every time it's 20/20 hindsight. So,
and you got to love it when the critics have never been out there in the position to try to make those decisions. They're just there to criticize.
That's right. And you'll get sued.
Yep. It's
I
truly
don't
is a catch
talk about
22.
Any of that.
Well, you got to, when it comes to protecting life, human life, and especially mm-hmm. U.S. citizens, you got to make the call. You got to do what you got to do.
And you got to live with your call, and you don't put it off on anybody else. But on the leadership side, though, it's different. They're not talking about terrorism. Well, I developed some 20 things that really I expected. And they were kind of fun, not funny, but they were things that I'd give out to people that worked for me. Rules for leaders or something. I think that was it. And it was very clear. It was not about I shall not. It was just about this is what I expect from you. And give them that. Like, take care of your people. learn everything, don't ever lie. But then I developed in my own mind three career killers. And the first one was, don't ever lie to me. And I can't handle somebody coming in and telling me. And that's why we didn't go out with information about what the 9/11 event was about or about the African bombings, and because it's just not true initially on major crisis. The facts, they're not lying about them. They're just reporting things they think they saw, car bombs in front of the State Department, et cetera. And then there were a couple other ones. But the other one, I guess, is you got to be loyal to the person you work for. And that is not blind loyalty. That is the ability and the wherewithal to stand up and say, hey, listen, that's a bad idea. I don't think we ought to do that. And I had people talk me out of doing some bad things that probably people would have gotten hurt over. And I listened. Mm-hmm. And then the last is don't ever take credit for somebody else's work. And they used to try that on me at headquarters for a while. They'd come up and say, this is a paper we wrote, and I'd read it and I'd say, I don't think you can write that good. Who wrote this for you?
Did they own up to it?
Linda was down there, helped. I said, well, get Linda up here. I want to talk to her.
Yeah.
That spreads like wildfire too. And I always tried to treat people as if the roles were reversed, if they were criminals or whatever they were. But
right.
But there are evil people. And so.
Right. What you're talking about here is principles of leadership.
Yeah.
And that's what makes a good leader. You got to let your people know what it is you expect of them. If they don't know what the game plan is, how are they going to achieve it?
Yeah.
You know, one of the most simple things that I like to do when I was the director at the OCDF Fusion Center, that was my last position at DEA before I retired, is whether it was an agent or an analyst got their GS-13. That's journeyman level. That's, you makes pretty good money. It's like being vested, that kind of thing. It's not really, but you're there. You're at the high level because your next step is a supervisor. And especially with the intel analysts, because they get treated like second-class citizens sometimes. And most of the time, I kind of refer to our analysts as the brains and the agents are the brawn. So I would call in. I remember one particular time, and I told the girls GS what I was doing. I called the whole group in. And we were sitting in my conference room, and I said, came in with a very serious look, and nobody knew what was going on, and I swore the GS to secrecy, had the ASAC in there. And I said, I just came back from a meeting with the administrator. The administrator of DEA, the head of our entire agency worldwide, and you know what the discussion was? It was this group right here. They're like, now they're on pins and needles, like, oh, there's an ass chewing coming. And I said, and specifically, one of you people at this table was mentioned and discussed. And I'm calling everybody together because I want this to never happen again. And then I went on and I just kept bringing my suspense there for a couple more minutes and then just announced that the reason the administrator called me down there is because so-and-so has just been promoted to a GS-13 and we're all here to congratulate you. And the sigh of relief from the whole room, just like, my gosh. But you know what? They never forget that because you took 10 or 15 minutes to talk to them.
That's right.
And it just because you're the boss, because you carry a title, doesn't make you any more important than anybody else. I'm getting off on a whole different topic here. We're not here to talk about leadership principles, but that's
maybe
what makes a successful leader.
Sometime. I've gone back and forth. Can you teach leadership? I don't know the answer to that, but we are off base here. So.
Yeah. Well, and I will say one more thing. The term common sense.
Yeah.
But we also know common sense is not common.
I'll tell you what, though, but I always treated the support people at FBI headquarters. I mean, they had my respect, and particularly the ones that worked in the operations center. I mean, they, two stories about that. They called me at night, and they screened some calls that, thank goodness, and and it was kind of a close relationship. And I always go by and say hello and thank them for what they do because they controlled a lot of it. One of them had a brother that was a security officer, FBI police, that watched the guards and they raised the gate and all that stuff at the Hoover building. And I got a call one night and his sister worked upstairs. The guard was downstairs. She worked in SIOC. She said, "Mr. Watson, you need to come in, blah, blah, blah. You got a 20-minute standby call for the White House or something." It's like 3 o'clock in the morning. I said, "Okay, I'm on my way." So they kept calling and saying, "Where are you? Where are you?" And I said, "It's very unusual." And I said, "I'll be there in 5 minutes. I'm just got by the Washington Monument," or whatever it was. So I drove in the back where I usually drive in, and he's out there standing up at 3:30 in the morning, right by the login place. And I never will forget it, that his sister called him and wanted to make sure he was not sleeping or something. So that was right, okay. Right. I didn't mind that. Didn't even question about it. Didn't even ask about it. So I roll in there, give him my badge, and he says, "I don't know what it is, but it must be bad." And
I'm thinking the same thing.
He said, "Yes, yes, it is, but it's not here. It's overseas."
Yeah, jeez.
But they were good people, man. They'd do anything. So the other deal was we had the old SIOC building, and after I got going with the terrorism stuff, they had speed dials in there. And so they had FBI director, attorney general, White House, and underneath it was my home phone number on speed dial. And so years later, about 3 or 4 years later, we moved into the new facility. It was remodeled and redone. And I went in there and I saw White House and attorney general, stuff like that. I didn't see my number. And I felt like, "What? Y'all forgotten me?" And so I went out there and asked the lady, and she says, "What are you talking about?" She said, "Every one of us know your home phone number by heart and the cell phone number."
We don't need a speed dial.
That's exactly right. So I said, "Well, this must be a sick job you have here." So that's it.
Hey, you mentioned the SIOC. Explain for our listeners what a SIOC is.
SIOC is a place that we meet in. It's conference room. I'm not going to go too much in detail here. It's internally inside the FBI building or J. Edgar Hoover building. And there's all kind of rooms and stuff you can have private conversations on. A lot of secure technology in there, like the civets where you're on TV with the White House and all these other people. And it's a 24-hour, 7 days a week. If you call the FBI, you'll get them.
Would you call it a crisis center?
Yeah, that's the word I should have used, the crisis center. But it's running 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And so I give them credit. I could call anybody. They'd get them on the phone. I don't know how they did it. Even the governor of Pennsylvania or something called, complained about something. And one of our agents did some wacky stuff or something. So, but you could say, "Hey, I need to talk to the ASAC in Houston." They didn't matter. So
you got them.
You know, so
now
I would. I'm sorry. The only thing that popped in my mind too is real funny. We were working full time in there, and then very seldom did I get out of there. Working hours were like 8 to 9:30, or 8 to 5:30, something like that. But it usually started around 6:30, and it usually ended about 8 o'clock. I was in there trying to go home one night, and something came up on the domestic side, and I had a section chief that had worked for me. It's a good guy. And I said, "I don't know. I'm not fooling with this. It's his job." So I told him to call him and put him on the phone. And they called back and said, "We can't get a hold of him. What? Try again." And so I was just kind of got mad. And I said, "Well," I didn't send him an email. So I typed up this email and said, "Look, I'm here. You're not. We can't get a hold of you. I can't do your job and my job. If you like your job, you're not going to have it very long," or something like that. I mean, it was really nasty, and I never do that. And I usually if I did, I'd just hold it till in the morning. I know he had some legitimate reason or something. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't think anything about it. Went home and came back in the next morning, like it's 7 o'clock in the morning. And my EA says, "There's a guy that had the same," or Burnham, or whatever the guy's name was. I'm not going to say what the name is. "Is calling you from Alaska." And I said, "Really?" And he said, "Yeah, he's calling. And he says he thinks you're mad at him." And I said, I don't even know anybody by the name of Smith or Williams or what. Who is it? And he said, well, it's the ASAC out there. And I said, oh, okay, so whatever. I said, yeah, what's up? And he said, Mr. Watson, he said, I don't know what I've done, but whatever it is, I can fix. And I sent that thing, used the wrong middle initial.
Oh.
And this guy out there hadn't slept all night, and he was working. And I said, oh, I'm sorry, I apologize. And I'm sure that's framed up somewhere in somebody's basement or something. So I have stories, all stories. What else you got?
I was just going to say, I would get emails from people in the field, especially on Special Operations Division, mm-hmm. and, you know, you're under a lot of pressure. And
yeah.
I would sit down, and I knew not to hit that send button, but I would write out the emails. I wouldn't even put the address who it's going to because I was afraid I would.
I was stupid. I put the address in there. So
I had guys that worked for me that I trusted, and I type up this scathing email, and then I call them, come in here a minute, read this. They come in and read it, and I said, you just tell me the truth. What do you think? Boss man, I don't think I'd ever send that to anybody. And then, I didn't.
Yeah.
I did. But it, you know, just helped you get work out that.
Yeah. Well, good. I'm glad to hear that.
Stress.
You know? Yeah. I don't know. So mercy. Yeah.
Now, after the embassy bombings in 99, looks like you were promoted to something called the first assistant director of the new counterterrorism division.
That's right.
Is that right?
And yeah.
Now, what is it? Why is it new? What's this all about? This is something new going
this
on
is about
in the
threat of terrorism going on. We were very understaffed when I became the section chief of the terrorism section back after rotating back from the agency. It was like 40 people trying to work 1,000 cases. And we only had a few analysts. Director Shree's credit, he saw this as a threat, particularly after the embassy bombings, that we needed our own division. And he created. And that's where that was created. It's like the CID division, Criminal Investigative Division. It's like the Intelligence Division now or Finance Division. It's a separate division. I reported directly to him.
To the director.
To the disappointment of the deputy director, who generally didn't want to be involved in any of that, so any of what I had to offer. And there's stories I could tell about that. So that was a big deal. That was the 13th division created in the FBI.
Wow.
And now I think they have 26 or something. I don't know. It's a large
number. Holy cow.
And so that gave me the opportunity to sit on the executive career boards. And well, I was doing that beforehand, but it was helpful.
And the executive career board, just quickly explain that if you would.
Yeah. Once you get up to grade 15, the next promotion's SES, and you go through a process that's called senior CS, is senior executive. And it's a career board made up of the deputy director who chairs it and the ADs, three of the ADs, I think it's CID, me, and inspection or something else, four or five. And we'd review the applications for jobs and who put in for what jobs, who put in for, and go in rank order and try to rank them. And then they would be sent in to the director, I think a list of 5 or 10, and he would pick one of them.
Yeah.
That's the way.
And those SESs have to be approved by the Attorney General, right?
Just the AD and above level, I think. And my memory's fading because Reno had to approve me as the AD of the new division. Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah. I can't
remember.
I got it on my glory wall up here, but I can't see it from sitting down here behind the desk.
You get a big certificate, and it's a big deal. So
supposedly. It is. It's a real milestone in any person's career, I think.
Yeah.
So
the thing, I don't even have it on my wall, but in January of 01, I was selected because all the terrorism work, this was before 4/9/11, before Free retired and before Reno left. they have presidential awards and executive awards for the executives. Mm-hmm. And they give out one, usually just one for the senior executive of all the FBI people. And I won that in 01. And
very good.
It was a very good bonus money that kept me there. And then they both left. So that was it. And proud of that.
We've been going here for a while, and I just want our listeners to know that there is still so much more to cover. And Dale has agreed to come on for another episode. So, and we're going to get into what happened on 9/11 because he's intricately involved in that. But there's a few things that went on prior to that that we also want to cover. So,
yeah.
What I'm saying is thank you for being here on the second episode with Dale. And this is going to be one of our unusual ones where there's going to be a third and maybe even a fourth. We'll see how it goes. But thank you again for joining us here on Game of Crimes with Murph in the Morning. Hey, gang. Well, this is the end of part two, but this week we have a part three, which comes out tomorrow. In the meantime, just a reminder that Game of Crimes is now posting interview videos on YouTube. You can find those at Game of Crimes Podcast. Our website is gameofcrimespodcast.com, where you'll find all our episodes, our guest book list, merchandise, and more. And for more content, join us on patreon.com/gameofcrimes. I have several monthly episodes that range from silly to serious, so come on over and join the fun. In the meantime, everyone stay safe. We'll see you tomorrow for part three.